Welcome to New City Church's podcast. We're a small, non-denominational church in Nashville, Tennessee, practicing the way of Jesus together. For more information on who we are, what we do, and some resources for your faith, you can check out newcitynash.com. But we hope you enjoy this message and that it blesses you.
Wasn't planning on starting this way, but I find myself lately, for whatever reason, about literally everything, just saying, I know nothing. So I'm going to start out that way today. I know nothing. Today we are continuing our series called A Christ-Haunted People, and we're talking about wisdom. The past couple weeks we've dealt mainly in Romans, but today we're looking at wisdom statements. So I figured we're going to start out with a little game, okay? So basically the way the game works is I'm going to give you a quote. It'll be on the screen, and then there are numbers below. Israel, you can go pull up the first one, with four different options, and I did numbers instead of letters so that you can hold up a finger for which one you think it is. And I will give you one hint. One of them is not going to be used at all for a quote. All right? So, spread love everywhere you go. Let no one ever come to you without leaving happier. Some twos, some threes, some fours. It was Mother Teresa. Yeah. Good work. All right. Second one. This one might be a little bit more popular of a quote. Success is walking from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. One, some twos. All right. Yeah. Number one. It's Winston Churchill. Come on. All right. Third one. All our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. Yeah, this one's probably the most obvious. Yeah, number two. That's great. And I think that's the last one I have, isn't it? All right, I'm going to do one extra one. Leave the list on there, which is, if you're going through hell, keep going. Oh, you're right. It's also a quote. It's also a quote from one of these people. Anybody got a guess? Yes, if you're going through hell, keep going. One. Yeah, one is not used. So, yeah, it's Winston Churchill. So, good work. Anybody get? Laura, did you get all of them? Four for four. Yeah, you get a prize later. Yeah, cookies. There's some coffee back there. Help yourself to get as much as you would like. We live in a time of sound bites. Where things deserving of nuance are summarized in a tiny little statement. And we see catchy, memorable statements. And what do we do with them? I know for me, even just as a preacher, I feel the pressure to come up with like catchy, memorable statements. But maybe this also goes to my personality type. But I often immediately think of the exceptions to whatever catchy statement I can come up with. Or maybe that's just that I'm not good coming up with catchy, memorable statements. Also could be true. So what do we do with them? Do we latch onto them and hold them to be true, or do we notice the exceptions and throw them out and not use them, or is there something in the middle? The Bible is filled with what might be referred to as wisdom, and while I'm certainly not trying to associate all of these quotes that we just read with the scriptures, I do see people offering scriptures like tweets that can feel like pithy platitudes. To someone in the midst of any type of circumstance. And today we're going to focus on the book of Proverbs, which is full of such statements. And to be honest, some of the statements in Proverbs, I hear them and I immediately think of the exceptions. Proverbs 22:4, for example. True humility and fear of the Lord lead to riches, honor, and a long life. I know plenty of people who that's not the case for, and I can think of many ways in which that verse is taken out of context and used to give some really not helpful teachings. I think about Jesus himself, who was killed, but did he not fear the Lord? I think of Job, who trusted God and was faithful, and his friends accused him of sinning because why else would he feel such a way? Because true humility and fear of the Lord leads to those things. So if I don't have those things, I must not be humble and I must not fear the Lord. So what do I do with this? Do I resolve just to use this and then point people to if-then statements? Well, if this is going on in your life or this isn't happening, it must be because. Or do I throw them out? Do I become cynical? Do I think everything is without meaning, or there's no general principles for life, or is there somewhere in the middle? So as I mentioned, we're in our third week of our series called A Christ-Haunted People, How Incomplete Pictures of Christ Leave Us with a Distorted View of God, Ourselves, and Others. And this week we're looking at wisdom. And this is kind of related to the characters we talked about 2 weeks ago, which was that of Jesus as like a hyper-religious Jesus or an anti-religious buddy sort of Jesus. One that would hold on to any form of like religious kind of teaching and the other one that throws all of it out. For this, one side, well, really both sides, kind of sees truth or wisdom as a mathematical formula. So one side sees them as a mathematical formula to success, and the other sees that these things aren't always true, and therefore are not worth holding on to. Both hold a similarity, which is that statements of wisdom are some form of mathematical formula. 1 + 1 = 2, if, then. So a brief note about that, and then I'm going to give you another example or two. When I say these caricatures, the idea is not that you would fall into only one, or that you would fully associate with them. They're kind of like areas on a spectrum to help us better understand. So another example of a proverb that's similar to the one we read before, fear of the Lord lengthens one's life, but the years of the wicked are cut short. Well, like, what do we do with martyrs and people who were killed for their faith? What do we do with people who seem to be terrible people, who seem to live a really long time, and people who are wonderful and kind and godly, who don't? There's another proverb about training up a child in the way that they should go, and they will not depart from it. I know plenty of people who turned out to be kind and gracious and wonderful people despite their parents. And there's also plenty of people who, well, thought they were being kind and wonderful parents but weren't. Kids turned out fine or didn't. And there's also plenty of people who were kind and godly and thoughtful, and their kids went a totally different path. Obviously, these things are not always true in a mathematical formula. Psalm 73, we even see this, where it seems to, if we're looking at it as math, contradict what the proverb says. Psalm 73, for I envied the proud when I saw them prosper despite their wickedness. They seem to live such painless lives. Their bodies are so healthy and strong. They don't have troubles like other people. They're not plagued with problems like everyone else. Well, that seems the opposite, does it not? So we see them in the scriptures even wrestling with these same sort of questions. God, if I trust you, then didn't you say that in the Proverbs this is what would happen? So even the scriptures are filled with places where this happens and where it doesn't. So here are the two caricatures. When it comes to wisdom, one would be not allowing room for exceptions. The other would be not allowing for general rules. So not allowing exceptions would basically resolve in its most extreme form to using the if-then statements. If I fear the Lord, then I will be rich, I'll be healthy, I'll be wealthy. This is what absolutely will happen. And if someone does not have this, then it must be, reverse engineer it, must not be that they are humble. They must be very arrogant or slightly arrogant or have sin in their life. They must not fear the Lord. In an extreme version, it can lend itself towards toxic positivity. And to be clear, toxic positivity is not just like being a positive person or having an authentic high level of positive emotions. It's emotional avoidance and invalidation. Rather than dealing with negativity, you avoid it at all costs and might throw out statements that sound positive. So, for example, if someone is like, you know, saying, oh, I'm really walking through this really hard time, and someone immediately, rather than sitting you within your pain, immediately goes, well, at least you're not, or it could be worse, or, but you have so many things to be thankful for. Could those things be true? Sure. But often that resolves into toxic positivity, into ignoring the pain of others. It also can see negativity or negative circumstances and people's circumstances as always their own fault. So Carly, back in January, preached on Job. Job's friends would be an example of this, saying, you must have sinned and done something wrong for you to be walking through this thing. Which, that's interesting. Doesn't Job seem to contradict these principles that we just read about in Proverbs? The second caricature would be not allowing general rules. So this would be, I'm not even going to use those kind of statements because I don't think they're helpful, can lend itself towards cynicism and eye-rolling rather than seeing the general wisdom. And in this, you can fail to see your own fault in the situation. So for example, this is not a proverb. This is just something I've learned to be true about my own anxiety. Caffeine makes a difference in how anxious I feel. If I pass a certain level of how much caffeine I've had, it is often that I will feel very jittery, very anxious. My limit used to be like if I moved from 2 cups to 3 cups. I'm not 100% sure where it is now. But somewhere in that general range, it might be a little more since having a kid, I've upped my tolerance perhaps. But like with any sort of principle, so like let's say you're anxious and someone says, hey, it's good when you're anxious to seek the Lord and pray about it. This overly cynical person might say, well, obviously that doesn't work. Whereas I think a better general principle is like, that is an important thing to do. Seek the Lord, pray. Also, like the Lord can heal you through medicine and through therapy and like through all of these other things as well. So both of these kind of lead to some responses. One, perhaps the not allowing exceptions would be an ignoring of pain or dismissing pain to if-then statements. Another one would be judging of others, viewing people as simpletons or people who obviously haven't walked through enough in life, or you must have done something wrong to deserve all of these things that you're going through. So this brings up a question. What is wisdom? Is wisdom an if-then statement? Wisdom is like applied knowledge. The Bible Project has an excellent series on wisdom if you want a really deep dive. They have several videos and then I think 7 or 8 podcast episodes that are about an hour long if you're interested in taking a real deep dive. I'm about 3 or 4. Wisdom, broadly speaking, is about living well in God's world. So in the Proverbs, there's a lot of, particularly in like, I think it's chapter 10 and on, Proverbs pertaining to all sorts of areas of life, from sex to friendship to money to forgiveness to speaking to alcohol. Like, the idea is that God's wisdom principles of like applied knowledge, how to live well in the world, pertain to every aspect of your life. Think of an aspect of life, probably somewhere in there. So a couple things that Proverbs are and are not, also from the Bible Project. One, Proverbs are probabilities. This is a general rule. Proverbs are not promises or formulas. And, all right, we talked about this as the book of the Bible, right? And the Bible's made of 66, this Bible's made of 66 different books, okay? We talked some about reading the Bible in context. One of the ways that we read it in context is reading the verses that are before and after and reading it in the context of the, like, one of the 66 books that it's a part of. It's also really, really, really important to read whatever verse or section or book of the Bible in context of the whole overarching narrative of Scripture in order to understand it. Because we see other books that fall into wisdom literature, like Ecclesiastes and Job, that deal with the exceptions to the rule. Like Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher. Completely meaningless. Now, that word that's translated there might not be the best way to translate it. It's more, I think the word is hevel, which is like vapor. Everything is vapor, meaning like, it's not saying that life doesn't have meaning. It's that anytime I try to reach out and grasp it, it's like trying to grasp for air. It's there, but I can't seem to latch onto it. Job, as well, deals with the question of, why do bad things happen to seemingly good people? And Job's friends are criticized for seemingly using this proverbial sort of wisdom on Job. So read as a whole, we see both a general rule and exceptions. Life is too complex for formulas, but these proverbs offer helpful guiding principles. And it's important to note here, too, that our Western kind of understanding of truth doesn't totally line up with the more, I think, biblical understanding of what truth is. So in John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I'm not going to ask you to define it, but if someone was to ask you to define truth, most likely we would give a series of statements. 1 + 1 = 2. We would, you know, whatever that would be for you. But Jesus does something different here. He defines truth as himself, as a person. That truth is less so facts to be known about and more so a person to be known. That there's a difference between just knowing about something and knowing someone. And so what also happens for us in this kind of concept is that anytime that one of these things that we've held to be true, whatever doctrinal belief statement about God or faith or the world or worldview, literally you name it, gets questioned, my whole concept of what is truth starts to kind of unravel. But if truth isn't just a series of facts, but instead is a person to be known, this actually propels me deeper into knowing him and understanding him. It allows a whole lot more room for doubts, for questions. This is just a hypothetical example, but like, if I thought Anna, my wife, like did not like a particular type of food, then come to find out she does that change how I like feel about her? Hopefully not. I hope you all would say, no, it does not. It does not. It does not depend on what type of food. But it actually, I could take that as like, oh, you told me wrong. Or this is actually a deeper way to understand, and I must not have totally known. How much more so with God? That our doubts and questions can actually propel us deeper into faith if truth is a person to be known and not just facts to be known about. I can know all the right things up here about God and not actually know him. As James says, even the demons believe and shudder. I can know this, but not actually know him. And what wisdom is, it's about applied knowledge. And knowledge is an interesting word in Hebrew too. In Hebrew, sometimes, this might be a little technical and not that interesting to you, but it's I think it's relevant. Sometimes in like Genesis and other places in the Hebrew scriptures, like the word for sex will be described as like a knowing of someone, like that they knew each other. It refers to more than like, now I know the things in my head about this person. It's like an active participation, a knowing, a knowledge, and something intimate that happens there. And so the perspective of knowing is not like, all right, I have my doctrinal statements down in my head. Not that that's not important, but it's that I intimately know this other person. I have an intimate connection with God. So wisdom is like applied knowledge, not only knowing it, but doing it. And so here we get to this verse that Daniel read earlier. Proverbs 3, 5 through 6, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Now, if you're like me, this already brings up, if I really dive into it, brings up some questions and some things I'm like, I don't know about all this. So let's unpack it. First, trust. Well, trust is a loaded word. I put trust in people, and they really hurt me. I thought they were this way, and then they turned out not to be. So I've learned to trust in myself, but even me, I don't know that I'm as reliable as I would like to think that I am. What is trust? And when people say trust in God, what do they mean? Because people throw that out too. What does it mean? It's more, going back to that knowing thing, it's more than about intellectually assenting to something. It's more than just saying, I agree with this to be true. It's like a confidence. The Anchor Bible Commentary said that it implies a feeling of security and confidence in the fulfillment of expectations. Basically, trust is that the one that you put your trust in can and will do what they are supposed to do. So it brings up questions, what are they supposed to do? And then we see who are we supposed to trust in. The next phrase, trust in yourself. Trust in the Lord. And the word that's there that's used for the Lord is the reference to God's like divine name, Yahweh. The I am, the one who was, is, will be. Trust in him to be who he is. Why? Because, well, he is. The one who is faithful when we're faithless. The one who is constant in our doubts. The one who is good even when we are not. The one who, as Carly said earlier, is a good father who loves us and wants a relationship with us. Trust in him to be who he has always been and will always be. And then we get into this word, trust in him how? With all your heart. Now, I think a lot of us, for me growing up, I think of my heart, like I feel like I'm a heart-oriented person. Feelings is what I think of. My emotions, trust in the Lord with all my heart. And when I have like this mountain top high experience with God, and he feels really close. I can trust in him. But what do I do when a lot of my life I feel like he is not close to my feelings, my heart? The Hebrew understanding of heart is different than our understanding of a heart. It's really more trust the Lord with your whole person. The Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament gave a bunch of definitions for this word. One would be the organ, so that's similar to us. Another would be seat of the vital force, one's inner self, a seat of feeling and emotions, inclination, disposition, will, intention, attention, consideration, reason, determination, courage, your mind in general, and as a whole, and your conscience. Trust God with all of you, with the seed of all of your life, your mental, your physical, your emotional, your spiritual, like all of it. Trust God with your whole person. It's saying put your confidence in Yahweh from your head to your toes, from your heart to your hands to your minds. In every area of life, trust him to be who he says he is going to be. But what does this mean? Well, we see kind of a glimpse of it in the next verse, because it's supposed to, if I trust in the Lord, then I do not lean on my own understanding or depend on my own understanding. My understanding of what? Like, I like the way I understand some things, you know what I mean? I think I understand things, well, it depends. I said today I don't know anything, and that's kind of how I feel today, but some days I feel like I understand things well. The Bible Project, once again, has a great podcast on this, and they don't point out, I haven't heard them talk about this verse in particular, but they talk about wisdom literature, and that they said that what wisdom literature and really the scriptures are doing is a massive like hyperlink pointing back to the beginning of the story of the Bible. Back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where humans were presented with a fundamental choice. Do I trust in God's wisdom and take from the tree of life, or do I take it and try to get wisdom on my own accord by eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And this is super interesting to me. Tim Mackey, who's one of the guys with the Bible Project, said that the tree of knowledge of good and evil, or tov and ra, or the Hebrew words, might be better called the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, as opposed to evil. Because sometimes this word ra, or for bad, evil, means evil, but other times it's just like, I don't know, like if I had a bad piece of pizza, did the pizza have like a moral will attached to it? No, I don't think so. There's a place in Jeremiah that talks about bad figs. There's a proverb about having a bad tooth. Now, does your tooth have like ill intent towards you? You might call it evil. We also do see, though, people refer to as ra or evil when they do bad things. If a person is ra, they are evil. But we also see interesting things where God does ra. And our translations will often translate it into like, God did this thing that sounds evil. There's one where God sent a spirit, a ra spirit, to Saul. And most of our translations say, God sent an evil spirit. Well, shoot, like, does God send evil? Is that what that's saying? But if you understand it more, it's like a bad, harmful, God does ra to those who do ra. That we see in Jeremiah that God speaks ra, like that would bring upon catastrophe, bad, but it's not always like morally evil. So, this trusting God or depending on your own understanding points back to two choices in the garden. To choose to eat from the tree of life or go against God and eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Now, why was it bad to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad? Well, I mean, I hope my answer would be because God said it was, that that's enough for me. But I always kind of wondered, like, doesn't my faith and religion and like what my parents taught me have to do with knowing what is good and bad? What's implied in the story, though maybe not explicitly stated, is that God would instruct them in what is good and bad. It's not that God didn't want them to know what is good and bad, like he was trying to reserve that for himself. The picture is that of Adam and Eve as, like, morally speaking, children in need of learning. And that the posture of like, let the little children come to me, is an invitation for us to have a childlike faith of needing to learn from God, rather than trying to take the wisdom for myself of eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Instead, I participate and ask God to give it to me. So Solomon, who is the writer of most of Proverbs in 1 Kings 3, there's a famous passage where he asks God for wisdom and to know the difference between right and wrong. And if I remember correctly from the Bible Project, I didn't look this one up myself, but I believe that's Tov and Ra as well, to know the difference. And he describes himself as a little child who doesn't know his way around. Solomon wrote the majority of Proverbs. And so what we see in this is kind of a hyperlink back to the Genesis story, where he is allowing God and asking God to create wisdom within himself instead of trying to take it for himself. Now, we see other places where Solomon very much goes and he takes. There's a lot of similar language to the Genesis story. But there's a contrast between being wise in your own eyes and you deciding what is good and bad versus allowing God to do that in you. And the problem with both of these caricatures that I mentioned earlier is that both of them can claim too much wisdom in your own hearts instead of trusting the Lord. That I know what is good and I know what is bad. And we end up leaning on our own understanding. I read a book a while back called The Biggest Bluff, which I think I may have mentioned to some of you before. It was about Texas Hold'em poker and a psychiatrist, thinks he was a psychologist, who got trained in poker. And she showed this thing called a Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but the basic premise of the Dunning-Kruger effect is that when someone starts to know something about something, they immediately think they are incredibly apt and intelligent and understanding of the thing, an increased level of confidence. As someone starts to learn more, they realize how little they know. And when someone moves into expertise, they realize that maybe they know a good bit of things, but there are still a lot of things which they do not know. So for example, like Tim Mackey is with the Bible Project, I've heard him say, as best as I understand it, here's how I understand this. Ask me again in 5 years. Then he gives an answer that is way better than what someone over here who would say, well, the Lord said it, and so I believe it. And I think this is a really helpful principle for wisdom and being right in our own eyes, that we're given a question. What does it mean? Like to not depend on our own understanding. That we might think we are wise in our own eyes, but our eyes are often wrong. And especially when it comes to knowing what is good and bad. I mean, you don't have to raise your hands, but have you ever looked back at your life and thought of something that you did that you thought was a good idea? Only to realize it definitely wasn't, and if I could repeat that, I probably would not do the same thing. Unless, of course, you have a philosophy of, I have no regrets because I learned something, but you know what I mean. Our eyes can play tricks on us. God saw in Genesis 1 and 2, or in the creation story, God saw 7 times that it was good or very good. The first time that we see a human seeing is in Genesis 3:6, and we see that Eve sees, and she saw that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was good, and it was beautiful in her eyes. It was desirable. This was the tree that God said, if you eat of this fruit, you will surely die. So we're given this option. I see it. It's attractive. I want it. And then I'm presented with this. Do I trust the Lord, or do I say, I'm going to take it? The Bible Project offered this really helpful framework for Genesis 3 that repeats in a lot of stories in the scriptures that pertains to our response to like kind of these options of leaning on our own understanding or trusting in the Lord with all of our hearts. The first was when you see something, that she saw it was good. The second would be an attraction to it. It's beautiful. It's attractive. This third step would be, I want it. I desire it. And then the fourth would be where the choice comes in. God said it would kill me, so I'm not going to do it. It's not what I ought to desire, so I'm not going to do it. Or I see it. I like it. I want it. I got it. Yep. Good. I was hoping somebody was going to catch that reference. Good. Ariana Grande was who it was. So we see this framework repeat time and time again of like seeing, attraction, desire, and then a choice. Now, the choice may be to actually do it. The choice may also be to cultivate the desire within you, moving from desire into coveting, where you start to, or that's one way of understanding coveting, where it would like, you would feed it and grow it within you. So what do we do? We see in the next line of the proverb, in all your ways, acknowledge him. Or another way to translate it might be, in all your ways, keep him in mind. In everything that you do. When I'm presented with this seeing and I'm attracted to it and I desire it, turn your mind back to God. Take every thought captive, bring it to him and ask him, what should I do? I think of my son, he's really into chalk right now. And he's so funny because whenever we're like using the chalk, he will start coloring on the ground and then he will look at like the piano or whatever and he will start looking and looking like he's gonna color and then he will look at you, waiting for you to say no. Now sometimes he still does it, but often if you tell him no, he like pulls back. He goes here and keeps going, and it's just kind of a lengthy process. I remember one time we were using his little like his little cozy coupe, which is a little car, and eventually he got to the, he would come over with the chalk and he'd look at it and he'd go, no car. I was like, that's right, no car. And I think that's a helpful posture to take with God. Sometimes like I see it, I like it, I want it, but like what do? Is this, okay, no, okay, oh, here? It's this posture of like a little child of everything that we do in all of my ways and everything I do, keep him in mind, acknowledge him. And then we see this line, and he will make your path straight. Now, when I said earlier that there was some of this proverb that I was like, I don't know that I, immediate reading it, I'm like, this seems like my lived experience, because my lived experience with God has been a whole lot more like this, and ups and very deep downs. That's also depression, but deep downs. Another way to translate this would be, he will make smooth your path. He will smoothen them, if that's a word. Smoothen? Not a word? Okay, mixed emotions. I will check later and we will find out. So I want to show you this picture, because we often, when we think of our past, all I know is what I've experienced, right? But God is bigger than I am. So I want to show you two pictures. Anybody know what this is? Mars. Jasmine got it. It's Mars, actually. Yeah, no, it's Earth. What can you not really see there? Mountains, valleys, animals, people. You got it. Good work. How much more so with God when it comes to our paths and smoothing them or making them straight? What looks to me like this may actually be God working something beautiful. Here's another picture. This was the famous Earthrise photo taken by Apollo 8 astronauts during their trip around the moon on December 24th, 1968. I can see very, very little. Sometimes in our life, what God is doing with us or what's going on in our life feels like a series of broken shards and really painful circumstances. And what we cannot see, because he is the potter and we are the clay, if I'm going to mix metaphors, is that he is forming and shaping something beautiful, like a beautiful mosaic of stained glass. That he does make smooth our paths, but it might not look that smooth from here, but you zoom out 30,000 feet. And all of a sudden, you start to see that God has been orchestrating this beautiful thing and even using what was meant to do ra and using it to do tov, or good. So what do we do? How do we grow in wisdom? I'm going to end with offering a spiritual practice that I think will be helpful for you. As a church, we focus in on spiritual practices as a way of growing in our faith with Jesus, as a way of kind of putting it into your body. One that I think is very, very helpful for wisdom is the practice of fasting. And I'll explain to you why. But this is our focal practice as a church. We'll do a later series in the fall, diving deeper into fasting and working on practicing it together. But we invite people to fast with us on the first of the month. Fasting is an exercise of faith, not through your mind, but through your stomach. And what I've experienced with fasting is that it puts a space between seeing, attraction, desire, and a choice. So what I mean by that is, let's say, for example, I like Doritos. And I do like Doritos. I see the Doritos, if I don't have good self-control or just a normal day, I see the Doritos. Before I know it, my hand is in the bag of Doritos. I've eaten quite a few Doritos, and I'm now feeling not so great. And then I think, I didn't really even want all those Doritos. Fasting helps put a degree of separation between that, helps space those things out more, where it goes from, I see it, I want it, I like it, I got it, to like, I see it. Yeah, that looks good. I do want that. And there's a further degree of separation, so when I fast more regularly, the Doritos now, I think about it before my hand's in the bag. And that's one of the side effects that you start to notice as you fast more and more, is that it puts a degree of separation between you seeing it and you immediately doing it. Now, it does it with food or social media, whatever you're fasting from, but I think it does that with all the other areas of your life as well. Let's say, for example, that you struggle with like pornography or something along those lines. Fasting can be a really practical way to grow and separating between I see it, I want it, I like it, now I'm doing it, and I wasn't even thinking about it, and I didn't want to. To, all right, well, I've been practicing not doing the thing that I want to do. I see it, I like it, I want it. Okay, do I do it? In all my ways, I acknowledge him, and he'll make my path straight. It's a way of putting space between these things, and God, I think, actually starts to change our desires as we do it. That I start to realize, you know what, I didn't even really, I mean, part of me wanted the Doritos, and I'm not bashing on Doritos. I will eat, I'm probably going to get some this week, maybe, because I'm talking about them, but. But I should pause first. I'm going to think about it before I go and get the Doritos. But it helps put that space. And I start to realize, you know what, I don't actually, part of me doesn't even really want this thing that I've been telling myself I can't live without. It does that in arguments too with someone, you know, where before you know it, you're saying the thing that you said you wouldn't say, or you're responding in the way that you said you wouldn't respond. When you have a regular practice of fasting, what it does is it puts a separation between I see it, and this is just how I'm going to respond, to noticing what you see, how I'm seeing it, I'm evaluating it, I want it, and then turning to God and asking him. It puts a degree of separation. So my challenge for you this week, I would invite you to fast on the first of the month, but I would encourage you, since the first of the month just happened, to find a day this week and fast from something. I think food, if you're able to, is a really great option, but social media or TV or something along those lines is a good option too. You may not notice a difference in doing it once, or twice, or three times, or four times. We overemphasize what we can do in a day, but underemphasize what God will do in us over a long period of time. But like for me, this lesson in learning and fasting was not something I set out to do when I learned, like when I started fasting. It was just kind of what started happening. And I noticed it when I wanted to get a snack. And I was like, oh, I want a snack. I'm not already having my hands in the bag. So I would encourage you to find a day, try it. I would encourage you to try it several times and just see what the Lord does. He will grow you in fruits of the Spirit through things like this. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Will you all pray with me?
Hey, thanks for watching the service. We pray that it blessed you and helped you grow closer to God. If you are in the Nashville area, we'd love for you to join us sometime. If you're not in the Nashville area, we'd love to help you get connected with the local church if you don't already have one. But we pray that God blesses you this week and that he grows you closer in your relationship with him and with your community, and that he uses you in a powerful way to be a vessel of his good news in everywhere that you go. May God bless you.